Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Adam Koch is my name, Ozan Ibrahim and Rodney McCune are my co-hosts. Gents, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
Now, I think it's fair to say that we've all sent our fair share of embarrassing text messages over the years. You know what it's like. You write the message and you send it to the wrong person. Or we've all, I guess, received our fair share of embarrassing text messages that weren't necessarily destined for our inboxes, but something very unusual has happened with the text messaging platform Signal and, US officials accidentally sending the wrong message to the wrong person in the wrong group. Ozan, talk us through what on earth am I talking about?
Well, I don't even know where to start, Adam. It became obvious about 24 hours, almost 48 hours ago, that a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Goldberg, who is actually the editor-in-chief of the Atlantic magazine, wrote an article. And I think the first couple of lines of the article were, I was mistakenly included in a group where the government was discussing their plans to bomb the Houthis in Yemen. Of course, that caught everybody's attention. And what happened and the way he described it, and I would encourage everybody to read the Atlantic article that he published, which is a very, very, very scary, interesting, funny, a roller coaster of emotions, really, article about the whole situation. But to just put it simply and succinctly, Jeffrey Goldberg was accidentally added in by Michael Waltz from the administration into a Signal group that was basically involved Marco Rubio, of course, the defense secretary Pete Hegseth, vice president JD Vance, senior advisor to the president Steve Miller, and many other people, Tulsi Gabbard, national intelligence secretary, and they were discussing their plans to bomb the Houthis in Yemen, which took place about the 13th of March, I believe. And they decided to set up a Signal chat for this. And I mean, it effectively, when you look through the article and when you see a lot of the screenshots, it literally reads like something that you would have with your mates talking about the footy on, you know, going to the football or going out for drinks on a Saturday. You've got the vice president coming in with his views about how he thinks that it's not a great idea to bomb the Houthis at this point in time. You've got, you know, Pete Hegseth talking about what I understand are some seriously secret war plans. And then once the actual bombing happens, is the point where I believe this journalist realizes that he's actually on an actual chat with a whole bunch of White House officials and government officials planning this, because I believe when he was initially put on there, which was about 3 or 4 days before the bombing, he was under the impression that somebody was, it was a bit of a scam or somebody was playing a bit of a game with him, etc. So he silently stayed in this whole Signal chat. And once he woke up on the morning of the bombings, he realized, okay, this is real, and I need to do something about it. So he subsequently wrote an article, and effectively, some of the chat is just unbelievable. It's absolutely hilarious. They're high fiving each other after it happens. Mike Waltz is sending emojis of all sorts of American flags. You know, fist bumps of all this sort of stuff. It literally reads like the group chat that I have with my high school friends, as I said, talking about where we're going for a drink on Saturday night.
You were going to say when you bombed Yemen.
I was going to say, yeah. Well, yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it is just horrific. And what's striking about it also, and I'm sure Rodney's got a few things to say about this as well, but within that text message exchange or Signal exchange, they talk about, and this is JD, this is the crux of JD Vance's opposition to bombing the Houthis. His argument is, well, why don't the Europeans do it? Only 3% of the actual shipping goes through the actual Suez Canal, which is obviously why they did it, because the Houthis are very strategically placed, and they're bombing and they're preventing ships from being able to pass the very important trade route that is the Suez Canal. But his argument is, why don't the Europeans do it, given that a much more significant percentage of their trade goes through there? And then Stephen Miller comes in, weighs in, and says, well, look, we should do it, but, you know, we've got to make sure that the Europeans understand, and, you know, we need to get some sort of financial reimbursement for this, etc. As I said, it's just, it's amateur. I mean, it literally is amateur hour, not to mention a major breach of security, complete incompetence, and, you know, it's just surreal, absolutely surreal. And I think, as one top diplomat that remains unnamed called it, it's, you know, horrific to see in black and white, but hardly surprising. I couldn't have summed it up better.
So from my perspective, there's maybe three domestic points of interest, and then there's the external component. Internally, they're using an unsecured chat for government business, so it's open to be, those signals more secure than some of the others. The coding and so on is open source, so it is possible to be hacked. So it's not a secure government channel. So that's one significant error, notwithstanding the fact that they added in someone externally and didn't even notice somehow, which is compounds that element of risk. Then there's the fact that they had message delete switched on for some of these messages, which means they're in breach of legal regulations around retention of government records, which would have happened had they done it within an approved government communications channel. And then the third domestic component, which will come out, is that the plans that Hegseth shared, in whatever format it was, also included not just the names of targets and details in terms of the types of munitions and the manner of the operation. This is well in advance of it actually happening, but also detailed the names of informants who had supplied, presumably on the ground, targeting data. So again, those people's lives are potentially at risk. So this is a real mess. But it's clearly not the case that this is the first time they've done something like this. This is the first time they've been caught, and therefore there must be dozens of similar reckless conversations on Signal involving some or all of these people, which will no doubt be the source of hackers' ambitions over the next days and weeks. The external point is the attitude towards Europe, the fact that Europeans are described as freeloaders, and it's like they want this PDF and invoice to Macron on WhatsApp after this, or Signal after this event happened, to say, no, you've got to pay for the missiles or whatever. There's no calculation whatsoever in allies, in fellow democracies, in any of these other issues that would have put people on the same page. This is purely, we bombed this, you're the beneficiary, potentially, you've got to pay no matter who you are. And it's sobering. And as Ozan said, not surprising, but, you know, you still got to see it in black and white to realize that, you know, this is the reality of where America's at. And it's not just Trump. It's right through the regime, as well as the fact that they don't necessarily agree with the action because they see it as inconsistent with the policy of moving towards isolationism and not doing stuff on behalf of others, or perceived on behalf of others, because there's no suggestion that this was requested of the US either. But the fact that Trump said it's going to happen, and those, you know, Vance disagrees, and there's some murmurings about timing and consistency with other things, nobody really seems or feels able to challenge or to go back through some sort of feedback loop to have that discussion to see whether it really is something that wants to proceed. They're all just wholly subservient as well to what Trump wants to achieve. And, you know, next week he could say something completely inconsistent again, and these fools would just go off and try and action it, probably have the similar murmurings, but just basically do what they're told. It's quite shocking from an external perspective, but it's also the reason that American attitude and policy towards its allies, that the polls in both Canada and Australia are swinging the other way, which is not the outcome I suspect that the Trump White House wants, or the likes of Vance would see as, you know, a fellow ideologists. But, you know, they're pushing people away from them. And, you know, any suggestion that Europe was going to have to go its own direction has been cemented by what we now know is happening, not just what we suspected. Now we know.
Yeah, we'll get to the Australian and Canadian elections in a moment. But, I mean, what's really interesting about this is Jeffrey Goldberg, the journalist, the editor of The Atlantic, who was at the centre of the, I guess, being accidentally added to this Signal group and finding out all these plans, is he had this story before the bombs started falling on Yemen. He actually said in subsequent pieces and interviews that he deliberately did not want to go ahead with this story because he was genuinely worried about, you know, the sharing of information and the potential threats to American military personnel on the ground. And, you know, he's then redacted sort of parts of the messages that exist. And I mean, one, it's extraordinary. And as a former journalist, I can sympathize with Jeffrey, you know, basically sitting on the scoop of a lifetime and not revealing it. But also secondary to that is, you know, the fact that he was thinking about national security implications more than these guys were. And by these guys, you know, Ozan ran through the list of the people. But, you know, the nature of the conversations, the American flag, the fire symbol, the, you know, the fist pumping and all that kind of stuff, I think is quite worrying in the regard that something like this could happen. And then Trump comes out and effectively has a go at Goldberg and doesn't sort of, you know, he defends what's happened. And he said, well, this guy's been, you know, he was sort of insulting in some of the language that he used. And then there's no sort of, look, we stuffed up, right? And this shouldn't have happened. And if anything, we thank the journalist for not, you know, compromising national security. He's just come out all guns blazing on the journalist, which is very Trump. But it seems that this is not resonating so well with the public, to your point, Rodney. And I think that's where some of their crisis communications work is now starting to come and bite them in the backside a little bit more than what they think that it would have in the past.
I mean, I think
go ahead, Ozan.
I think it is painting a very broad picture of how incompetent these people are, and it's feeding this narrative about their incompetence. And again, I think people still are giving them a bit of a chance. They're still technically in the honeymoon period, etc. But what is becoming very clear is people are like, I like what they're doing. The what is not a problem. It's the how. I mean, we want government spending to be cut, but not by, basically sacking people who are in charge of the nuclear weapons safety, or in charge of ensuring that Ebola doesn't spread, or in charge of, the bird flu epidemic, etc. So this is just another thing. I mean, they probably love the fact that these people are doing what they're doing, but the how is going to hurt them incredibly. And what I find incredible is, as you put it, Adam, they are now, you know, attacking the journalist. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of arguments running around, going around the MAGA world, talking about how the journalist should be locked up for treason and for divulging, state secrets, etc. This is just incredible. I mean, thank God that he actually published this, because it has now put a spotlight on some of the practices that Rodney alluded to before. That are just incredible, that are putting not just the American people in danger, but putting the world in danger. So I think it's, you know, there's only, I think, so much that they're going to get away with when it comes to such blasé responses to what are extremely, extremely bad practices, but also just utter incompetence, absolute incompetence.
Look, they went out and attacked the journalists. It's their usual. It's gone in 2 hours because the news cycle moves on. Attacked the journalist, and Hegseth, you know, claimed that this is a journalist who's the source of many hoaxes and so on, and said that no battle plan was discussed. But the problem is that they do have to appear before committees that scrutinize stuff, and this isn't going to go away, I'm afraid. And, he thinks he can say no battle plan was disclosed. Well, what was disclosed is the next question. What short of a battle plan was disclosed? And they can't answer that because they don't want to make any admissions. They want to say the journalists or the outlets disreputable. Trump's old line of, and it's getting tedious now. Oh, that's not a very successful publication. People are going to get tired of this stuff. And what they've had to do then is move into a more professional crisis response after the initial bluster, where they're trying to manage down the situation in a much more controlling or controlled way or professional way. But their initial response was just the usual bluster, let's move on. And it hasn't happened this time. And the fact they've needed to adjust their response suggests to me that this isn't going to go away as a story, and this is not going to go away as a point of accountability. And it's a great opportunity for the Democrats to seek some sort of scalp within the administration, and politically they should really drive at this one.
Well, one of the main sort of politics, or I guess political considerations at the moment, is from one of the gentlemen who was indeed in that signal group, and that is J.D. Vance, the Vice President of the United States. J.D. is heading to Greenland. Ozan, what's that about?
You tell me. I have no idea. Apparently, they've decided to... him and his wife have decided to do a state visit, uninvited, might I add, to Greenland. To just, I suppose it's kind of like soft diplomacy. It's kind of like what you do when you're about to move into a house. You go and do a bit of an inspection, etc. But it's very unclear why they're actually going. Look, if you were to speak, I suppose the glass is kind of half full type of thing. It might be that they're going to convince or to comfort the Greenlanders that, the US is not trying to take over Greenland. But, I'm not a glass is half full type of guy. It seems very odd. I don't see that they are welcome. They haven't been invited, and certainly the Danish government has made some stern comments around their visit. So yeah, it should be interesting to see. I hope their visit is more successful than Don Jr., who effectively went to a diner and started handing out MAGA hats. So I hope it's a little bit better choreographed than his. Is it to Greenland?
No, I don't underestimate how much of a shambles this one could be as well, especially because it's not an official visit and who they'll end up meeting. And the real challenge is, and I don't know the answer, do the Greenlanders within their small population and political discourse have a far-right party that they can meet or engage with? Who knows? Maybe go and check that afterwards. That's maybe homework for me for today. Does Greenland have a far-right party that they could hang out with while they're there? Who knows? So I thought it was going to see a dog race, or a dog's sledge race, or a husky race or something was the official reason given. I don't know.
But it's truly bizarre. I mean, absolutely truly bizarre.
It's attracted criticism from the Danish Prime Minister, who openly criticised the trip, calling it an example of unacceptable pressure on Greenland and Denmark. How much of this is actual foreign policy at work, and how much of it is, I guess, J.D. Vance positioning himself now to be the heir apparent of Trump?
I think most of what's motivating Vance at the moment is to me, 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 don't forget about me, I'm still here as well, because he's obviously been moved down the pecking order by Musk. And he, the Oval Office incident with Zelensky, and I'm sure there's an interesting signal group discussing that probably before and after. But that was all about, look at me, I can be relevant too. And I think a lot of what drives Vance is stuff that he wants to do that he knows will be consistent with Trump, so he doesn't fall out with him, but also stuff that allows him to try and have the media spotlight on JD. Yeah, he's a strange character. He's a really strange character. I don't have much more to say about him than that.
Do you get the feeling, though, that Elon Musk has taken a bit of a step back in the last few weeks. I mean, I suspect he's probably realised that he's backed himself into a bit of a corner because, you know, at the end of the day, his business is significantly suffering with, you know, a whole bunch of Tesla showrooms being, you know, vandalised, a lot of Tesla cars being vandalised. You know, I think he's realised, okay, maybe this is not such a good idea. After all, I'm a businessman and I need to look after my own business interests. I don't know. Do you think that that has a little bit to do with it? And perhaps, you know, maybe JD Vance doesn't have a lot to worry about right now because Elon Musk is becoming quite a toxic character in this administration. And it'll be very interesting to see coming back to the US away from Greenland, but there is actually going to be an election on which ends in April 1 for the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Usually these sort of elections don't get a lot of national attention, but this one in particular has because it's effectively a bit of a referendum on Elon Musk. He spent about $17 million on on one of the candidates that is formally not aligned, but very close to the Republican Party, you know, there's been about $81 million, I believe, being spent on the race, and it could very well be if Elon's candidate wins, the Wisconsin Supreme Court goes back to a conservative court. If the person on the kind of center left or the progressive side wins, it remains a 4-3 split. But this is be very interesting to see whether you know what type of response that people are going to give to Elon Musk meddling in the Wisconsin Supreme Court race. Of course, I understand that there is a bit of a court case that involves Tesla, so he's got business reasons to do it. But it'd be very interesting to see. And speaking of special elections, take this opportunity to also, without exaggerating the outcome too much, it is a special election, I suppose, but in the Pennsylvania state legislature, there were two elections that were called. One was because of one of the people passing away, and the other one was a state senate position. The one that was for the state legislature was expected to go to the Democrats, so there was no surprise there. But it was very interesting to see that in the Senate, the candidate, the Democrat that won, won in an area that was basically that voted Trump in November last year by 15 points. So that swung back to the Democrats. Now, again, you can't read a lot into this sort of thing, but you know, it's not a great sign when in a state like Pennsylvania, you see such significant swings.
4 months too late, I'm afraid, Pennsylvania on that one. The fact that Musk is putting money into this election, the judicial election, again, shows to me that he's not taking a step back. And if he was ill-advised to politicise his business in the way he got involved in politics in the first place, it would be equally poor advice to tell him he can be quiet and somehow the winds of Tesla will heal, because it's not going to be the case. It's the brand is damaged, whether, you know, in quite a significant way, potentially irrevocably damaged. And he's responsible for that, and he put that at risk because he clearly, well, I would say he probably didn't anticipate the strength of feeling that it would stir up against him. But I do remember a number of podcasts back when we were discussing Musk's role before he really emerged as this sort of key player. It was the early stages of it, and I think we agreed that he would be the Achilles heel of the administration. He is deeply unpopular, he is damaging it, and it's very difficult for them to disentangle themselves from him because his money still matters and his clear strange relationship with Trump. This is going to keep playing out in a negative way for both Musk and his business interests and for the Republicans.
Well, speaking of elections, and you alluded to this earlier, Rodney, Canada's new prime minister has called early elections, and their Commonwealth brothers down in Australia Also about to head to the polls, yet to be called elections, but it does need to be held by May. So any day now, we're expecting the Australian Prime Minister to call the elections. Rodney, first take us through what's the mentality of going to these early elections for the new Canadian Prime Minister, and then we'll get to some of the political implications after that.
Well, look, for Canada, it was pretty straightforward. When Carney took over as party leader, he then became, in effect, the Prime Minister designate and then Prime Minister. But he doesn't hold a seat in Parliament, so he's not yet elected as a member of Parliament. So he had to call an election for that reason. There was also going to be a vote of no confidence on the Monday after the Friday he called the election in the government. He wouldn't have been able to respond in person to anything like that. So he really had to do it early as soon as he took over as party leader. At the same time, they're riding high in the polls. The wave of Canadian nationalism as a response to Trump's antics or his administration's antics towards Canada, whether it be on the bullying type approach or the tariffs or whatever it happens to be, has provided a liberal renaissance, centre-left liberals in Canada, not like in Australia, liberal renaissance in Canada, such that they're now ahead of the Conservatives on polling. The only caveat is there's still time between now and the 28th of April. Momentum has moved to Mark Carney and the Liberals. He obviously took over from Justin Trudeau, but it's still an election campaign to run out. And the Conservatives are good campaigners, and are the leader certainly is a seasoned politician. Carney doesn't have political campaigning experience in the same way. So it's a matter of him banking the lead that he's got and getting through the campaign without putting himself in any significant risk areas. But increased spending on defence, popular in Canada, given America position. His perception of him as someone who's economically competent to handle this difficult period again is a big plus. And there's other reforms that they've announced domestically, which have played well. So the new leader, but the old party has worked for the Liberals in Canada in large measure thanks to Donald Trump, but also a little bit of because they changed horses or changed leader in advance of the election. So it's looking fairly positive for the Liberals in Canada, and we'll see how that goes over the next few weeks. I'm sure we'll revisit it again.
Yeah, you're seeing a very similar type of trend in Australia forming. The current government is a Labor government, so a centre-left government in Australia, headed by Anthony Albanese, who's the Prime Minister. And, you know, it's fair to say that in the last 6 to 12 months, they've been struggling in the polls, with the Conservatives in Australia having a pretty reasonable lead. But now when you look at most of the polls, and you know, it's certainly showing that in the last month and a half, the trend has started to go very much in Labor Party's way, and you know, you're looking at very much so that the Labor Party has started to take lead, and I think, you know, it just comes down to many of these countries, Canada, Australia, and the UK. You know, many of the people in these countries are very, very disturbed and very, I would say, horrified at what they're seeing from their main ally and a country that they consider their friend. And they're seeing the rhetoric, whether it's the tariffs that are being imposed on all these countries or the rhetoric around some of the security measures. It's, you know, and people are starting to rally around the flag. And you're seeing this across the board in Europe as well. So yeah, I think if you're a conservative sitting in one of these countries, you'd be very, very upset with the way that the Trump administration has started, because it's very much put at risk, you know, the conservatives winning in these places. If the election was held before Trump got into power in Canada and Australia, the conservative parties would have won would have had resounding victories. But now that's all in question, and many of these polls are showing that the Liberals in Canada and the centre-left party, the Labor Party in Australia, are edging ahead.
So I think there's one other point which we don't know from these two examples. It's whether Trump's approach is helping the center left as a response to the Trump type perceived as center right government, or whether it's incumbency that it's helping. For me, it's probably incumbency because they're in the position to respond on behalf of the people as the sitting government at the current time, and that's why they're the beneficiaries, maybe more so than the fact that they sit on the other side of the, you know, the, I'm going to say the right-left divide to the Trump administration. And I wonder whether if there had been conservatives responding in Canada as the party of power, that they might have equally benefited in the way that the centre-left liberals have under Carney.
I think there's an element of that, but at the same time, you know, there's a very good reason for why Trumpism, despite making inroads in places like Australia and Canada, has never taken hold, because you know, these are not popular ideologies, these are not popular views that are held, and you know, I think it says a lot about the Australian and Canadian electorate that, you know, they have not given their approval for this brand of politics, and election after election in Australia, this brand of politics has been rejected. So I think the fact that they're seeing now Trump on steroids is really putting people off. And previously during Trump 1.0, they never got directly attacked. So most people didn't care about it. But now, A, they don't like the politics, they don't like Trumpism, but B, they're being attacked through tariffs and other type of measures. This is really making people angry. So, yeah, it doesn't have much to do with ideology, but it's becoming much clearer that people don't appreciate this type of politics in these countries.
Also, I think so much of the politics around these countries, and especially in the Australian context, just doesn't fly, right? I mean, Peter Dutton, who's the opposition leader in Australia, wanting to be obviously the next prime minister, you know, has called on things like, you know, sacking public servants, which is obviously what Trump did, looking at government spending, et cetera, et cetera. And like trying to use a lot of that Trump rhetoric, you know, looking to potentially change the constitution so that they could send, you know, people of certain origins back to their country. I mean, this kind of stuff just doesn't work in the country at the moment, because at least from an Australian perspective, what is top of mind for voters is very, very different. And this whole, you know, let's win our country back and make America great again. And I mean, Australians don't feel like their country is necessarily lost to people. Like they've got other things that they worry about, but it's that rhetoric is not working. And it's certainly the case in Canada as well. I mean, it's not a situation of copy and paste for centre-right parties to embrace the Trump moment, especially given that so much of what is happening in the US is proving to people, well, there's the idea of Trump, and then there's the reality of Trump, where we're seeing things like the, you know, the leaked stuff to Signal and all these court orders and the injunctions that are placed upon him, and the, you know, the multitude of issues that he's now facing. I just don't think it works.
100%.
Quite nice to see the wheels starting to come off so early. It's going to play out for a lot of drama and intrigue over the coming few weeks, I think. A big shout out to Pret a Manger on Waterloo Road for hosting me today for the podcast. The good people of London, sandwich bars are a great place to do, put simply.
Can you give us a bit of a rundown of, I mean, you lived firsthand the Heathrow experience. Maybe you should give us a bit of a rundown of that, Rod.
Yeah, so obviously I'm my trip to London was extended because of the Heathrow fiasco. There's some issues around the most senior figure at Heathrow leaving it to his deputy to decide whether or not to close the airport and go home for the evening. He says so that it'd be refreshed to take over the next day for the most important stuff, but it looked like he sort of copped out. So there was a bit of criticism in the media there. There's a bit of an issue around resilience and the ability to run an airport in this way. But there's also some, not evidence-based yet, because none has been disclosed, but there's some sense that this all feels very, unfortunately, timely, that this particular vulnerability has been exposed or highlighted in the way that it has. So there's definitely murmurings of terrorism or foreign state actors and so on around this incident. because it all seems far too convenient that Heathrow was knocked out in the way it was at the time it has been. But who knows? The police investigation's underway, and it may prove to be nothing more than a lack of resilience and poor planning on the part of the energy provider and the airport.
Well, never a dull moment, as I think we are constantly saying on this podcast. Gents, wonderful speaking to you both again this week. Catch up again soon.
Thanks, guys. Thank you. Take care. Bye.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroka Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.